Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. The terms deep state and shadow government have gained considerable currency since the 2016 U.S. presidential campaign. In his new book, The Deeper State, Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis reveals for the first time behind-the-scenes super elites who promote a false panacea through promises of globalization. He'll reveal how globalists are taking over the world's power centers, the instruments of global power and the secret hands of the global's evil puppet masters, the history of the world's superclass, the marriage of modern globalism and progressivism with deep roots in Marxism and Darwinism, the one-world government elite behind the European Union, the spiritual aspects of an invisible war, and its Achilles heel. Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis, The Deeper State, next on Coast to Coast AM. Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis is a Washington, D.C.-based broadcast national security and foreign policy analyst with 24 years of extensive experience speaking on tough issues with most major broadcast and cable television and radio outlets. He has extensive overseas work experience, Europe, Africa, Asia, the Middle East. That experience helps his current service as the Vice President for Operations and Project Manager at the Pentagon for Mesmo, Inc., a Maryland-based small business that specializes in language services, intelligence analysis, and security cooperation for the U.S. government. He has extensive policy experience, having served as a Vice President for Policy at the Washington, D.C.-based Family Research Council, where he focused on human rights, religious freedom, illicit drug policy, foreign affairs, and national security. In that capacity, he advised senior government officials, spoke internationally, and worked with the international bodies, such as the United Nations. He remains with the Family Research Council, Senior Fellow for National Security. He's a graduate of the United States Military Academy at West Point and the Navy Postgraduate School at Monterey. His special military training includes Ranger and Airborne Schools, Command and General Staff College, and the U.S. Army War College Strategist Course, as well as the Defense Language Institute. He's the author of several books, including Future War, Deadly Consequences, Never Submit, and his newest, The Deeper State, Inside the War on Trump by Corrupt Elites, Secret Societies, and the Builders of an Imminent Final Empire. Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis, welcome back to Coast to Coast. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me, Richard.
May I call you Bob?
Please.
All right. Let's sort of define our terms here. Let's start with globalism. When I think of globalism, I think like a lot of people, we think of free trade. We think of the unfettered movement of labor and capital. And many people out there probably thinking, so what's so bad about that?
Yeah, I would add instant communication to that as well. At the same time, Richard, it's a radical ideology. It's a humanist religion, if you would. And it's an effort to replace a national sovereignty with global governance. And it's pushed by a cabal of people of great wealth, people that consider themselves to be the elite of the world, selected for this coveted position because they're genetically predisposed. If you look at their backgrounds, you become convinced that these people live in a world all their own, but they want to control ours in a way that most of us just wouldn't appreciate.
It's been around a long time, hasn't it? I mean, it really goes back, as you point out, in The Deeper State, all the way to Nimrod, the world's first monarch.
No doubt. And of course, you know what happened then. Of course, we find that when man tried to consolidate the world, to, you know, build a tower to heaven, you know, that crumbled and man was scattered and his languages were confused. What we have today, of course, is an effort, and I think one that is better coordinated than ever before, one that is leading to a synergy in a way that control of all the power centers of this world are coming together in the hands of very few. It's sort of like a global oligarchy, something that should frighten us all.
How far along into the third quarter are we in terms of, you know, the globalists, if you will, having this thing totally locked down?
Well, I would argue that when we look at certainly the power centers, you know, you look at, you know, economically, you know, who controls the big banks, who controls trade and business, who controls even health and medicine, science, technology, and energy. When you make that list is rather small. And then if you look at the culture, you know, what in fact are they doing with regard to certainly the use of the media? Who's driving a lot of the mainline media today, much less the education establishments? And then if you look at governance, you know, the real push for global governance, whether not just the United Nations, but you know, you look at things like the European Union, certainly a lot of these major trade organizations, and how these NGOs across the world are bowing to the likes of these major mega organizations that are really wrapping their arms around the economies, the whole culture, and of course trying to impose this big government over us all. So I think we've moved pretty far. And the question is, I think, Richard, whether or not that can be pulled back. Our nation states, which is a target of globalists, are they coming to an end where borders are no longer in existence and national sovereignty is something of the past?
They've had it sort of going their way for so long that I guess, and obviously this is a big part of the book, is you know, the election of Trump really threw sort of a wrench into the works for them, because I mean, I can't remember in a presidential campaign ever when the two sides were so stark and laid bare that on the one hand we had the globalist Hillary Clinton and we had, you know, the nationalist, the patriot, some might say, of Donald Trump. Never before has it sort of been this out in the open, or did I miss something?
No, I think you're right. But there's a general recognition amongst even politicians on both the Democrat and Republican parties that, you know, we are quickly moving into a place that is hard to reverse. You know, even Jimmy Carter, not all that long ago, said we live in an oligarchy. Where there's unlimited bribery, certainly here in Washington, where there's complete subversion of the political system. Bernie Sanders, I would argue, who was manipulated by the DNC thanks to Hillary Clinton's great deal, you know, in overtaking that party, as revealed this past week by Donna Brazile. Bernie says that money owns the politicians of this world, and we live in an oligarchic form of society. And then finally, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, he talks about the Washington cartel. He says that, you know, politicians go to the highest bidder. And that's the sort of thing that I think that the American people and generally people across the world, they do see indicators of that. And it may be that we have gone too far. As Donald Trump said almost a year ago, right after the election, that this is an economic and political ideology, and that allegiance is supposed to be going toward the international institutions, away from these nation states. And these people reject private property. They have a preference for socialism. They want to control all the goods and labor, and they want to control your borders. So there's so many issues here that resonate, I think, and we see daily on the news. And of course, these tell-all books that are coming out here recently, to include Donna Brazile's, but also one by Edward Klein, All Out War, says that we are, in fact, in a war between those that are trying to preserve national sovereignty, whether it's here in the United States or elsewhere, against the internationalists who really want to control this world.
The foot soldiers for the globalists, have they been, by and large, have they been deceived? Are they willing participants? Are they well intended, you know, young people, millennials, who see this sort of utopian vision of a one-world government? I mean, how did they attract these legions of supporters and have these willing participants?
Well, I think it's manipulation to a certain degree through education establishments, whether it goes back to Dewey many years ago, and how the messages, and especially our colleges and universities have been fairly, successful. And the manipulation in the media, where there haven't been all that many alternative voices. Certainly, when you look at groups like Antifa, and you look at the tactics that are being used, rather they be subtle or violent, we're seeing gradual takeover of institutions, intimidation of people. People just fearful of speaking out because of political correctness in today's world. But they have recruited a lot of people. I would call them psychophants because I don't think they're thinking. I think they're just reacting to what they've been programmed through education and media to do. And that's unfortunate because I don't believe that's what our original founders had in mind. They wanted us to be people involved in the institutions of government. But yet our voice is being muffled to a large degree by what's going on in today's culture.
It's the forces of globalism and the globalists, they take the long view of history. I think about, for example, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which started out in many ways for Canada back in 1965 with the Auto Pact. I'm wondering, at that time we had Lester Pearson, who was a big supporter of the UN, a globalist, no doubt, and his counterpart at that time would have been LBJ. Do you suspect, even in 65, now over 50 years ago, they were talking well beyond just an auto pact? They had their sights set on a North American Union.
Well, there's no doubt about it. When you go back in history and you look at the likes of, Woodrow Wilson and what he had in mind at the turn of the last, next to the last century, to the 20th century, he was a big advocate of these so-called unbiased experts, something that Hegel, German philosopher of the prior century, had espoused. And of course, here we have Wilson, touting the importance of the League of Nations, which he was a big proponent for, didn't sail with the U.S. Senate, but he was really trying to get a global understanding and a call for global unity, so that so-called democracy could rule. And then much the same you found under the New Deal with Roosevelt and his espousal of the United Nations, which was successful, obviously, as well as the New Deal and other aspects of his very progressive agenda, bringing this country into an age where we have social institutions that our founders, I argue, never had envisioned.
And it is such an incremental process with the European Union. I mean, you could go all the way back to 1951, I think. Was it the Treaty of Paris where they started out? I mean, they started small, right? It was a community to trade steel and coal, and then it is, of course, has grown into a full, political, economic union.
Absolutely. And that's the sort of vision that the globalists have in mind, not only for Europe, but for Africa and the Far East. It's an idea that, is fed by their view of market freedom, global markets, consumerism. And then, of course, you have others. You have justice globalists, you have religious globalists and the like. But when, I think the reaction as well, Richard, here in the last couple of years to that, whether it be here in the United States with the Trump populace pushing back against the establishment in Washington, the globalists, I would argue the progressives, but you've seen the same thing in Western Europe. There is an element, obviously, because of Brexit, because of even the opposition against Angela Merkel with the new DFD, and Le Pen in France, or Geert Wilders in Holland, all of these, the Czech Republic, Austria, all of this reaction is, look, we want our national sovereignty. We don't want to be something, Manilaized across our entire region. We like our language, we like our culture, we like our people. We want to be a nation state. We don't want to be something, kind of lumped together with all these other places without a specific identity. This has resonated to a certain degree by a large part of these populations, and I believe it's growing.
There is a quote from someone in the book whose name escapes me, but you mention him, and he basically says this populist uprising that we're seeing now in the United States, in Western Europe, as you say, is the final sort of sigh, the final gasp, and that it's merely a blip, that the march towards globalism and a one world order is inevitable.
Well, that's certainly a position that I quote, but one that I think a lot of people have resigned themselves to just because of the momentum. You know, the coordination, the communication, the sheer power, economic and cultural power that exists in the hands of the few today has put us into a position where it's difficult to turn around. You know, certainly in the early part to the mid part of the 19th century in this country, we had a rise of populism led by Andrew Jackson, who really said, look, the original founders were more of an oligarchy than they truly were a democratic movement. Yeah, they were democratic as far as what they called the virtuous people, and only virtuous people were those that had land, owned land, that had the power. And so Jackson comes in and says, no, I want to empower the people. And so he put together I suppose, an electoral system that gave a voice to the people. We took away, for instance, the power of the states to appoint senators, and we elected senators. We established party systems. And so we grabbed back power to the peoples. Well, that is becoming far more difficult, and in part because of, like I said, the power in the hands of the few. And all you have to do is look at how the DNC in the hands of Hillary Clinton manipulated, you know, the primary against Bernie Sanders to recognize that wealth and position power really does dominate, even at the national and international scene. And of course, you mentioned NAFTA and other programs out there. That's where a handful of people, once again, have control over vast wealth and entire markets, entire countries. That's a scary proposition, but how will we reverse that? I'm not sure that we can at this point. There are a lot of people that don't want to, but I think those of us that are concerned about our own voice, about the independence and the sovereignty of nation states, need to say something. And, you know, perhaps this is what the revolution that brought Mr. Trump into office is about. And I think to a large degree, we've seen the same thing in Europe.
Although we are getting some mixed signals from Trump, the nationalist. In fact, just today, we had a White House sanctioned report come out that agreed with a number of studies saying that man is indeed responsible for climate change. And I had to do a bit of a double take there, saying, wait a minute, this is from the White House that pulled the United States out of the Paris Accord. Why the mixed signal on this, for example, climate change?
Yeah, that is confusing, and I did as well see that, Richard. I am concerned that Mr. Trump has allowed some of the same globalists that he spoke against to come into the White House. You know, H.R. McMaster, I would argue, is much of a globalist. You know, there are a number of others that are in the administration that seem to subscribe to more of a globalist than a nationalist perspective. We'll see in time whether or not, you know, what this really means. I'm afraid, though, as Mr. Trump is a deal maker, that he's dealing with the devil here. And the devil, of course, are the globalists that are sucking up all the power in the world. And he's trying to find some sort of accommodation from them. And we'll see whether or not he's successful at that. I hope that this is an anomaly, that this climate thing is not, as it's been portrayed, a compromise in a way that is really fundamental to those of us that are concerned about national sovereignty and then caving to what I question is good science.
All right, Bob McGinnis stays with us. The Deeper State, Inside the War on Trump by Corrupt Elites, Secret Societies, and the Builders of an Imminent Final Empire. Here's Donovan and Jeff Beck taking us into the break with Barabajagal, right here in Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. We are talking with Bob McGinnis, Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis, his new book, The Deeper State. It's about the elites, their secret societies, world power centers, and evil motivations behind the chaotic contemporary world, pressing all life toward a final one-world empire. And the modern trigger that briefly lifted the veil on this darkness was the election of President Donald Trump, who exposed the power brokers, their evil agenda, their techniques and ideology, much like when one is shocked when lifting a rock in the forest to discover hidden underneath slimy, poisonous vipers. We'll get back to that conversation in just a moment. Just a reminder that George Norrie is going to be at the Time for Truth UFO Symposium. That's at the Aquarius Casino Resort in Laughlin, Nevada. That's November 10th. And Saturday the 11th, that's fast approaching. He's going to be hosting a cocktail party. That's on the Friday, November the 10th. And then he'll interview Clifford Stone on the Saturday, November the 11th, the Time for Truth UFO Symposium. And for more information or to order tickets, go to coasttocoastam.com and find George in the menu at the top of the page and then scroll down to George Norrie's events. That's Time for Truth UFO Symposium at the Aquarius Casino Resort in Laughlin, Nevada, Friday, November the 10th, Saturday, November the 11th. Back to the deep state and globalism when Coast to Coast AM continues right after this. Bob McGinnis is the author of The Deeper State, Inside the War on Trump by Corrupt Elites, Secret Societies, and the Builders of an Imminent Final Empire. There's a blog that you quote from Tyler Durden, and which asks a very interesting question, and I'll ask it to you right now, and that is, are globalists evil or just misunderstood, Bob?
Well, I suppose it comes down to what the definition of is. I would argue that...
Where have I heard that before?
You know, in there, I would argue that ideologically, the globalists tend to fit, you know, what one psychologist called them as weird. In other words, they tend to be Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. So that's how they typify it. But I kind of put it into three, I suppose, issues. I see that they tend to be occultic. In other words, that means secret knowledge. And that's what drives them to these secret associations, which the Bilderbergers or the Trilateral Commission and the like, which are real organizations and they are secretive. Some of them, like Hillary, I would say, are Luciferian in that they reject established norms, certainly biblical norms, and they embrace self-esteem and the advancement of self. And then they tend to be moral relativists. In other words, you know, they kind of decide what the right is rather than the balance of the culture and society. So I would say ideologically they tend to be like that. They're progressive in their thinking, and that being that they want reform. They, for instance, in the United States, they reject our Constitution as a bedrock if they think it's malleable. And they're very much opposed, as you can guess, against traditionalists. They want to impose kind of a socialistic approach. They reject private property except their own. And, of course, they're lined up on a host of other issues, one of which you've already mentioned, climate change and a number of other things. So I think that, you know, in my classification, yes, I would say a lot of them are sheer evil. Some of them, I suppose, if you look at their behavior profiles, they seem to be a bit, some people call them deranged. George Soros calls himself God in his own biography. And then, of course, he says at the same time he might be just a little bit mad, which he attributes to his own grandfather, who he said, in fact, was mad. So they may be to a certain degree, psychopathic in their behavior pattern. So there are a host of issues there that, certainly, indicate that they may not be like the rest of us. They certainly are very egotistic, and they're self-absorbed in terms of wanting to control the world and their own making. And I suppose if you have hundreds of billions or certainly billions of dollars, that control is something you've grown accustomed to and something you want to exercise in remaking the world in your own image.
I wanted to talk to you about President Trump's visit to Asia. This is 12 days. It's going to be perhaps the most important trip of his young presidency. He'll be meeting with Xi, the General Secretary of the Communist Party of China. And obviously one of the important things on the agenda is how to denuclearize North Korea and how to enlist Xi and China's help in this regard. Now, is China sort of the model of how globalists see the world being run eventually? Do they use China as sort of the blueprint?
Well, certainly China has evidence of that. I don't know that it's necessarily the blueprint, because as we saw in the 19th Congress that convened and has finished a couple of weeks back in Beijing, that Xi has made himself basically for the balance of his life the new dictator in the likes of Mao Zedong. In the two-hour speech that he delivered there, he made it very clear he's going to sustain the economic growth of China, which is a tall order, to say the least, even though it is the world's largest economy. But he's also going to make China into a world power, more so than it has been up to now. And of course, given their double-digit increase in military spending over the last few decades, and their ability to steal most of the modern technology from us and then translate it into sophisticated fighting systems, which they are doing at a rapid pace, gives you the impression that, they are in part, perhaps, like this oligarchy that I'm concerned about, the rise of the globalist, because Xi is truly a globalist. As long as you want to embrace his view of a future world mimicking, to a certain degree, what the people in Beijing are espousing. And we see tentacles of that all over the world today. So, this trip is very significant. Clearly, Mr. Trump is going over there not only for trade reasons, access to Chinese markets, which we absolutely need to kind of level the playing ground here. And he is taking dozens of CEOs to hopefully come away with some good deals, but I don't think it's going to happen, frankly. But to your question initially, and that is North Korea, which is, of course, occupying a lot of print today, it is a serious challenge. He is, of course, arriving now and probably in the last few hours in Japan to speak with Prime Minister Abe. And I suspect he'll get some pretty good feedback there, especially when he talks to Japanese people, families that have been taken captive by the North Koreans so that they can learn the language, which is a novel way of doing things as the North Koreans would. And then President Moon, when he goes to Seoul to kind of figure out what their commitment is to self-preservation. But back to Xi, Xi's not going to give him everything he wants. What Trump wants is cut off the oil and send back all this basic slave labor, cheap labor, close down the bank transactions between the Chinese and North Koreans, and then really put the screws on North Korea to stop this madness before it gets out of hand. And I think from the Chinese perspective, and this is perhaps the leverage, before Japan and South Korea become nuclear states, which is, I think, inevitable if we don't curb the appetite of Pyongyang.
Well, we've seen sort of nuclear proliferation go, the other way. Maybe it's time nuclear proliferation, you know, swing back the other way so that it's the American allies that like Japan, like South Korea, like Taiwan, that are looking to build up a nuclear arsenal.
Yeah, well, I think, in fact, that's the case. The Japanese have in country far more nuclear material than is needed for a very robust nuclear arsenal. And of course, President Moon invited us to bring back nuclear weapons to the peninsula for self-defense reasons. So I do think that a proliferation of nuclear-armed states is something that's going to be a byproduct of this current debate. Good, bad, or indifferent, these countries are watching out for their own well-being and their own protection, and they see a rogue like North Korea and ostensibly Iran pursuing that. Now, of course, at the same time, they understand that Omar Gaddafi was kind of put in his place with regard to his small nuclear efforts, and then so was Syria under Bashar Assad. So, it is a mixed bag out there. We have to be careful about the messages. And I think that Trump's hard-nosed stand against what is going on in North Korea, it's about time. You know, we've been playing games with, Kim Jong-un's father and grandfather for the last 64 years, and we've come out on the short end of the stick. And yet, we didn't seem until here recently to find the nerve to push back. This is dangerous stuff, and this guy, perhaps, I don't think he's crazy, I think he's rational, but he's also calculating, and he's smart. He has every intention of preserving his regime and his own personal power, and that may come at great expense.
How does a nuclear North Korea serve the aims of the globalists, if at all?
Well, as long as he can be manipulated, and I would argue to a certain degree he can be, and we'll see, like you asked, whether or not Trump and Xi can come to some sort of accommodation and kind of put Kim Jong-un in a box. I think Xi could, and if Xi understands that to stop proliferation and to keep the U.S. Working with China, especially fueling its economy, which is a major objective, then that's probably going to happen. And Trump knows that. I'm sure H.R. McMaster has made it very clear that you've got to come away with something that is going to keep this guy in a box. So I suspect that we will get something. It may not be as public as perhaps we would like to see it, but if we stop seeing missile firings, and there could be one this week, frankly, just to welcome Mr. Trump to Seoul, which is not unpredictable given what Kim Jong-un has done in the past. But if we can put him in the box and China's cooperation, I think that would be good. But of course, part of the problem has been the Russians. The people in Moscow have fed a lot of technology to Kim Jong-un and his father over the years. They've developed a pretty good relationship where they buy Russian oil and they send tens of thousands of cheap labor north, and it's something they can use against us to give us a black eye. And the Moscow, of course, is not opposed to that.
I wanted to ask you about Putin, actually, because I'm trying to figure this guy out. I mean, the West has tried, the globalists perhaps have tried to portray him as another Hitler. I certainly don't think he's Hitler. He's not wearing a white hat. I would sort of cast him more in the vein of maybe a Peter the Great. I think, he's certainly a nationalist, but is he a countermeasure or a countervalence against globalism? Is he part of the globalist scheme? Is he a nationalist? Where is Vladimir Putin in all this?
Well, he's accommodationist as far as his own agenda. Clearly, he has major support within his own country when he's talking about preservation of the nationalism of the Russian Federation. He's watching that and doing a pretty good job of his own personal future as well as that of his nation state. He's bolstered his military to something that, has many of the instruments of military power that have not been allowed to diminish. He's in fact increased the submarine fleet, the ballistic missile fleet, his nuclear arsenal. He's improved upon not what it was during the Soviet Union during the Cold War, but much better today. Now, I think that from the very beginning, he's made it very clear that, he says the major disaster of the last century was the downfall of the Soviet Union. And so he's done everything he can to, cause it to rise again. We've seen a Middle East, policy, a Far East policy, pushing, back against the United States and Western Europe. He sees the infringement on his own border, whether it is in the Republic of Georgia, Ukraine, or in the Baltics. He has every intention of continuing to push back to intimidate those former satellites to understand that the Russian bear is not dead, but in fact is reemerging as a powerful player. And frankly, he has a nuclear arsenal that is the largest in the world. Though they have their very severe economic issues, and he's wrestling with that on a daily basis, I think that Putin is a very rational player. And to a certain degree, he enlists globalists to his own intentions. At the same time, though, he kicked George Soros and his billions out of the country because Soros was trying to manipulate him and the Russian system to his own liking, and that's something that, of course, a nationalist like Putin was not going to tolerate. So he's an interesting study. I'm not an expert on Vladimir Putin, an observer, someone who, quite frankly, is fascinated by the personality because I think he is being very successful against all odds, given where that nation has come from since the fall of the Iron Curtain.
I wanted to ask you about some of these breakaway republics and states. For example, Catalonia and Spain, they want to separate from Spain. We have Scotland, of course, have aspirations of independence again. Are these small countries or regions, are they rebelling against globalism, or are they being manipulated by the globalists? Because it seems to me if you break up Spain into smaller parts, Spain becomes weaker. There'll be, corporations in California probably that would have a larger GDP than Catalonia or some of these other places. Are these moves for independence, are they being manipulated behind the scene by the globalists?
Yeah, interesting theory. It's hard to understand, perhaps. I think the theory that breaking apart Spain makes it less powerful of a voice in the European Union, and especially in trade situations, and that's probably correct. It's interesting that because we've seen much the same thing, say, in Austria, and back when the Freedom Party in the late 90s was as a far-right organization making an impact in that government. I went over to Vienna and sat down with the leadership of the Freedom Party at the time and saw in them a real nationalist movement. They rejected the European Union's call to allegiance to Brussels, but wanted the power to remain at their home. So there is that strong populist populism within Europe, whether it's Le Pen or certainly Wilders or some of the others. But whether or not this is an objective by the globalists to tear apart the region so it can be easily manipulated, I think we're seeing some of that elsewhere as well, and that well may be the case. I suppose if I were inside the Bilderbergers groups, I would hear conversations like that about how to strategize in manipulation of nation states to undermine their influence. And that would be, I think, a reasonable proposition. So we'll have to wait.
All right, Bob, hold on. We'll take a time out, come back, continue to delve into the deep state. Here are the Beatles taking us into the break with Real Love on Coast to Coast AM.